Welcome to another edition of Hank Unplugged, the podcast that is committed to bringing the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people directly to your earbuds. And today is going to be the quintessence of that reality. On the podcast today, I have Dr. Stephen Meyer. He received his PhD from the University of Cambridge, and that PhD is in the philosophy of science. He's a former geophysicist. He's a college professor, and he now directs the Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture in Seattle. He has written three of the most incredible books we have ever featured through the Ministry of the Christian Research Institute and our various outreaches. One of them is the New York Times bestseller Darwin's Doubt, subtitled The Explosive Origin of Animal Life and the Case for Intelligent Design. The second is Signature in the Cell, a landmark work. And then his latest book titled Return of the God Hypothesis. And the subtitle is very instructive. We'll talk about this, but the subtitle says three scientific discoveries that reveal the mind behind the universe. And what is so great about this particular work is that Dr. Meyer explains extremely complicated subjects in extraordinarily accessible ways. And I think that's the genius, not only of this book, but all of his work. We have appreciated Dr. Meyer for many years at the Christian Research Institute and just delighted to host him on Hank Unplugged. Hi, Dr. Meyer.
Hello, Hank. It's great to be with you. It's been too long since we've talked, but I fear it's a consequence of how long it's taken me to write another book. So thanks for having me on.
Well, you know, it's often said that either the writer struggles or the reader struggles. And in your case, I'm sure you struggled. It took you a long time to be able to communicate what you communicate in the Return of the God Hypothesis in such a transferable way. I think people can read this book, grasp its content, and then make a difference for time and for eternity.
Well, I certainly hope so. I think one of the things that you and I are both aware of is that in our culture today, we have a growing group of agnostics and atheists, especially among young people. The pollsters are picking up this phenomena they call the rise of the nuns, the religiously non or unaffiliated young agnostics and atheists. And when you probe that group with polling questions, it turns out that science has played an outsized role in their disaffection with religious belief. 76% of young atheists say that the findings of science have made belief in God less probable. And I wrote this book in part because I've been thinking for 35 years about many findings of science that I think make belief in God not only more probable, but actually the best explanation for key discoveries about the origin of the universe, its finely tuned structure, and the origin of life.
Your book starts with a gripping story. It's the story of your debate with Lawrence Krauss, along with Dennis Lemereau. And that actually served as the inspiration for writing The Return of the God Hypothesis. The story, I say, is gripping because when I started reading your book, I couldn't put it down from that opening story on through the end of the book itself.
Yeah, well, thank you. It wasn't maybe the most pleasant night I've ever had doing a public event or a talk or a debate. I usually enjoy those things. And I debated Professor Krauss twice before, but on this particular night, it was at the University of Toronto. There were approximately 60,000 people watching online and 1,000 or 1,200 in the auditorium. It was an electric, intense atmosphere under very bright lights. And at that point in my life, I was struggling with migraines and bright light had been a trigger. And I got about 18 minutes into the 25-minute opening talk, and I suddenly couldn't see my slides. I was getting what are called ARA, little visual disruptions in my visual field. And then my voice started echoing in my own head. It was a kind of sequence that I know really well. But I also knew I was in serious trouble because it comes with something else called aphasia, which is the inability to pull words. And I kind of struggled through the last 7 minutes of the opening statement, tried to make my remarks as simple as possible. And there was a nice Canadian doctor who was driving me around, who pulled me off the podium and took me to a dark room while a third speaker, Dennis Lamoureux, spoke. Krauss had opened. And, you know, after that next 25-minute talk, I agreed I'd give it a shot. I came back and there was a, you know, spirited discussion, but there was a couple occasions in the discussion time when I actually yielded time because I was having trouble pulling words. And the one thing you never do as a debater is yield your time, you know. So, but at the very end of the debate, some of the symptoms started to dissipate a bit. And the moderator asked if we could summarize our key position about the topic of the debate that night, which was what lies behind it all. And I had come wanting to make an opening statement about intelligent design, but then in the discussion period, I'd wanted to explain what I thought about what science could tell us about the identity of the designing intelligence responsible for life. And I found myself, partly because I was having to be very succinct, summarizing three key discoveries that I thought didn't just point to intelligent design, but had decidedly theistic implications. Number one, that the universe, as best we can tell, had a beginning. Number two, that from the beginning or very soon thereafter, the universe in its basic physical parameters has been finely tuned against all odds and for no underlying physical reason to allow for the possibility of life, to allow for a life-conducive universe. And then number three, the discovery that inside living cells, even the simplest living cells, we have found digital information and a complex information storage, transmission, and processing system that exceeds anything we've built ourselves in our advanced high-tech digital computing. And so I just quickly ticked off those three key discoveries and said that, you know, for me, the ensemble of things that we've learned, that suite of discoveries, those three things together, point not just to a designing intelligence, but to a designing intelligence who has the attributes that Jews and Christians have long ascribed to God. Transcendence, an intelligence which is separate from the universe and therefore could bring it into existence and fine-tune it, but also an intelligence which is active in the creation and could bring about new forms of design and information long after the beginning, as we see in the origin of life. So after the debate, I got a lot of email from people who were very sympathetic about what I'd experienced with the migraine. And, you know, it was kind of interesting. Both the other debating partners were pretty aggressive, even when I was struggling with words. So I got a lot of, you know, sympathetic emails and that sort of thing. But the thing that really struck me was the number of people who said the one thing that they remembered about the content of the debate was that quick summary in the closing statement of those three facts. And I thought maybe it's time to write a book around those three facts and explain in more detail why I think they support what I call a God hypothesis.
You've already sort of hinted at this in your opening remarks, but I want to really underscore what you were hinting at, and that is the full implications of Darwinian evolutionary theory. And perhaps the best way that I can do that is to quote Professor of Philosophy at Duke University, co-director of the Duke Center for Philosophy of Biology, a man by the name of Dr. Alex Rosenberg. And he's someone who overtly says that Darwinian evolution is the only game in town. And then he talks about the implications of the only game in town. First of all, he says that 95% of the most distinguished scientists in America don't believe in God. And then he says this, the other 5% simply swallowed the biggest conspiracy theory of them all. And that is the story of how God put us here, or that is the story of the God hypothesis. And then when he talks about God, he asks the question, is there such a thing as God? And then he says, no. What is the nature of reality? He answers what physics says it is. What is the purpose of the universe? His answer, there is none. What is the meaning of life? There is no meaning. Why am I here? Dumb luck. He goes on and on in this discussion and finally says, what is the difference between right and wrong, good and bad? And his answer, and again, this is a professor of philosophy at Duke University. He says, there is no moral difference between right and wrong, good and bad. He goes on to say, anything goes, and then concludes by asking, does history have meaning or purpose? And his answer is, it's full of sound and fury, but ultimately signifies
nothing.
Yeah. So here you have someone who is overtly communicating the implications of a universe without God.
Yeah, absolutely. The problem with that whole, it's an excellent explication of the implications of first materialist theories of origin, and secondly, the worldview built atop them known as scientific materialism. If all that exists fundamentally, if the things from which everything else came are simply matter and energy within some space and time, then it follows that there can be no meaning in any ultimate sense of human existence. Nothing can mean anything to a rock or a planet or an atom or a quark. Meaning is something that is conferred by persons and is arguably best found in relationship between persons. So if the universe does not have a personal source, if it was not created by a personal being with mind and intelligence and self-conscious awareness, then when we die, there can be no meaning left in the universe because there are no persons left to confer such meaning. So Rosenberg has done a very good job of explicating what follows from a materialistic worldview. And he claims that that worldview is justified by, in this case, Darwinian accounts of the origins of new forms of life. There are multiple problems, however, with his premise. Voltaire once said that madness is reasoning correctly from incorrect premises. To claim that human life has no meaning, I think you could classify as a form of madness, but it does follow deductively from an incorrect premise, that being materialism and the underlying claims about strictly materialistic accounts of how everything came to be. He is right about Darwinism. Darwinism is not just the idea that life evolved or that it changed over time, but rather the idea that life evolved by unguided, undirected processes, in particular, the process of natural selection acting on random mutation. What Rosenberg seems unaware of is that even within evolutionary biology, and indeed among elite evolutionary biologists, there is an increasing recognition that the mutation natural selection mechanism lacks the creative power necessary to account for new forms of life, for fundamental innovations in the history of life, as opposed to minor modifications. In 2016, I attended a conference at the Royal Society in London that was convened by a group of leading evolutionary biologists who are dissatisfied with what's called the modern synthesis, the standard textbook neo-Darwinian theory of evolution. And they are calling for a new theory of evolution, or at least new mechanisms of evolutionary change that can either replace or supplement the mutation selection mechanism, because they understand that it lacks the creative power to generate fundamental morphological innovations in the history of life. Now, this is taking place at the highest levels of evolutionary biology, this discussion. It was also interesting that at the conference, one of the prime movers in calling for its convening declared at the end that the conference was characterized by a lack of momentousness, that apparently the assessment was that the evolutionary biologist there did a good job of explaining the problems with neo-Darwinian theory without really coming up with any new mechanisms that could remedy the lack of creative power associated with the main Darwinian mechanism. So there are good reasons to reject the idea that neo-Darwinism has explained away all appearances of design in nature, which is one of its key claims, because the designer substitute mechanism, mutation and selection, lacks the creative power to do that. In addition, there is no evolutionary explanation, even a plausible evolutionary explanation, for the origin of the first life from simpler non-living chemicals. And yet, in even the simplest living cells, we have exquisite evidence of design, again, in the digital information that's present in the DNA and the RNA, and in the whole complex information processing system that stores and transmits and processes the information necessary to build the proteins that keep cells alive. So we've got compelling indicators of design. in even the simplest living cells, and yet the origin of those cells has not been explained by an undirected chemical evolutionary process. So I think Professor Rosenberg is racing way ahead of what the evidence actually supports. He does a good job of explaining the implications of a materialistic worldview, but neither neo-Darwinism nor chemical evolutionary theories really provide the support for that materialistic account of origins that is necessary for that worldview to remain plausible, or still less, the default way of thinking for our scientific and wider culture.
And he's not alone. I mean, you have people like Richard Dawkins, who's made a cottage industry out of making dogmatic assertions without providing defensible arguments. So he'll say that the universe we observe has no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. And this seems to be one of those dogmatic assertions that he never really buttresses with evidence.
Well, that is, again, part of why I wrote the book, but also I love that quotation. If I could back it up just a clause or two, he actually says, before the part you quote, he says, the universe has exactly the properties we should expect if at bottom there is no design, no purpose, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. Now, that's a very significant statement. First of all, I love the way these guys, Rosenberg, Krauss, Dawkins, the way they frame issues, because they really, unlike a lot of people in the culture, they do actually take the claims of revealed religion seriously. They just reject them completely outright and do so on the basis of putative evidence in support of their alternative worldview. And those are people you can actually have a discussion with because they are looking at the big questions. And one of the wonderful things about this quote from Dawkins is that he actually implies, very clearly implies, that worldviews or metaphysical systems of thought can be tested or evaluated the same way we would test a scientific theory by looking at the evidence around us and seeing if what we observe in the natural world, seeing if its properties match what we would expect if a given worldview were either true or false. Now, by blind, pitiless indifference, and no purpose and no design, Dawkins is speaking of his default scientific materialistic or scientific atheistic worldview. And he's essentially saying that we can test whether or not that's true, because when we look at the properties of the universe, we can tell that the properties are such just as what we would expect if scientific materialism were true. I take that argument at face value, but head on, and say, but is that really the case? Is it the case that we would expect a universe, a physical universe of matter, space, time, and energy, giving evidence of having had a definite beginning in time, that matter, space, time, and energy began to exist a finite time ago? That is the implication of modern astrophysics and cosmology and something known as the Big Bang Theory or the inflationary cosmological models of the origin of the universe. No proponent of a materialistic worldview until recently has thought that that's what you would naturally expect. Materialism has always thought that matter and energy were eternal and self-existent and did not have a beginning. Secondly, materialists would not expect to find that the universe had been finely tuned against all odds, and again, as I said before, for no underlying physical reason, to allow for the possibility of life. This fine-tuning that physicists refer to and sometimes call the Goldilocks universe, where all these fundamental parameters, the strength of gravitational force, the mass of the elementary particles, the ratio of the strength of other fundamental forces to each other, the strength of the force that's driving the expansion of the universe, by which we also have come to understand something about its beginning. All of these fundamental parameters fall within very narrow ranges or tolerances that make life possible. Little tiny differences one way or another would render the universe a life-unfriendly place. And the odds of getting all of these things right is astronomically small. That's not something that you would expect on a materialistic worldview or on a naturalistic worldview. Sean Carroll, the famous physicist from Caltech, defines naturalism as a system of thought wherein eventually every event can be explained ultimately by the underlying laws of physics. But the laws of physics do not explain why what are called their constants have the precise values that they do, nor do they explain the exquisite fine-tuning of the initial conditions of the universe. So naturalism would not expect this kind of fine-tuning. And certainly a materialistic worldview, a naturalistic worldview, a Darwinian perspective – did not expect to find the exquisite informational complexity that we have discovered inside living cells. That complexity in the presence of digital code and information processing systems is completely unexpected on a naturalistic worldview. And you know that in part because the naturalistic theories of origins have been utterly incapable of accounting for the origin of precisely that information. So if you look at the three big discoveries that I address in the book, none of them are expected on a standard naturalistic or materialistic worldview. Scientific materialism of a kind that Dawkins defends and promulgates out into the culture is incapable of explaining those big three discoveries and certainly did not expect them.
As we continue the discussion, maybe it would be worthwhile to talk about the ideas that led so many people in Western civilization in particular to reject faith in God. The unguided chemical evolution as an explanation for the origin of life, and then unguided biological evolution as an explanation for the development of that life.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I tell a bit of the history of this in the third chapter of the book. I start by explaining that science began in its modern form in a decidedly Judeo-Christian context in Western Europe, and did so for decidedly Judeo-Christian reasons. The early scientists believed that nature was intelligible, that it could be understood, that it was worth studying systematically, because it was the product of a divine mind, the divine mind having built order and design and rationality into the universe such that we, with minds created in his image, could understand that order, design, and rationality. But we lost that perspective, largely lost it, in the late 19th century. And as scientists began to propose theories of how things came to be, theories of origin that made no reference to a designing intelligence or a creator of any kind, this started first in the field of astronomy when Pierre Laplace proposed an explanation for the origin of the solar system. It spread into the earth sciences and finally into biology, where Darwin proposed that he could explain the origin of new forms of life as a result of a purely unguided, undirected process known as natural selection. Not artificial selection, not intelligent design, but nature was doing the selecting and the guiding. And so that led very easily to a naturalistic worldview where nature seemed to be eternal, self-existent, and self-creating. And of course, Darwin's ideas were extended to explain the origin of human beings as well as other forms of animal and plant life, and extended in the other direction to, as you mentioned, explain the origin of the first life as a result of what are now called chemical evolutionary theories. So by the end of the 19th century into the early part of the 20th century, there was a sense that there was a kind of comprehensive narrative whereby scientists could explain how everything got here by undirected material processes, where that primordial matter, perhaps elementary particles and energy, was eternal and self-existent in just the same way that Jews and Christians always believed that God was the eternal self-existent thing from which everything else came. So every worldview has to answer that prime reality question, the question of what is the thing or entity from which everything else came. The theistic answer has always been God, a self-conscious person with will, intentions, and great power. The materialistic view is that there is no such person, personal source or intelligent source for the universe. It's not mind first, but rather it's matter first and matter existing eternally into the past. And so these theories of origins that gave plausibility to the materialistic narrative, the story of how everything came to be, eventually seemed to give strong support for that overall materialistic or atheistic worldview. And that became the default way of thinking among intellectuals by about the turn of the 20th century and throughout most of the past century, and in still a very dominant way of thinking in our time. But I think that is beginning to change, Alex Rosenberg notwithstanding. I think many scientists are seeing that these materialistic theories are inadequate, and many are opening their minds to the possibility that there is evidence of actual design in life in the universe. And thus, as I unpack the argument, the return of a God hypothesis.
Yeah, absolutely. And the subtitle, Three Scientific Discoveries That Reveal the Mind Behind the Universe. Maybe you can do a bit of a dive into those three, the evidence from cosmology, from physics, and from biology.
Absolutely. I mean, this is what's, for me, just absolutely fascinating. As you go back to the ancient Greeks, let's take the first one first, the discovery that the universe, as best we can tell, had a beginning. you go all the way back to the ancient Greeks, and there have been philosophical debates about whether the universe has always been here or whether it had a beginning. And it is one of the most remarkable things and a fantastic story that modern science has been able to answer that question to a fairly high degree of certainty. Not absolute proof, we don't get that in science, but as best we can tell, the evidence points to the universe having a beginning. And the story of that discovery begins in the 19-teens and 20s when astronomers first began to perceive that the light coming from very distant objects in the night sky, first called nebula and then later called galaxies, that the light coming from those distant objects was being stretched out. The wavelengths of the light were being stretched out so that they were longer than they should be if the objects in the night sky were a constant distance away from us. If you pass light through a prism, it will separate into different colors, red to violet. The red light corresponds to light with longer wavelengths, the violet with shorter. So the light coming from these distant galaxies was said to be red shifted. And this indicated that the galaxies were receding away from us. They were moving away from us. Just as a train receding from us causes the pitch of the sound to go lower, that corresponds to a lower wavelength of the acoustic wave. The light coming from the distant galaxies was being stretched out. It was longer than it should be if the galaxies were a constant distance. And so that suggested that the universe was actually expanding. As more and more measurements were taken and observations made in different quadrants of the night sky, this phenomena continually manifested itself. And that suggested a universe that was expanding outward in a roughly spherical way, like a balloon. Now, if you wind the clock backwards in your mind eye, if you back extrapolate, if the universe is expanding outward in a spherically symmetric way, like a balloon being blown up, if you imagine what that balloon would have been like at any finite time back in the past, it would have been smaller and smaller and smaller the further back you go. And eventually, all that material would have been congealed, the material of the galaxies would have congealed at a single point past which you could not go. You couldn't back extrapolate any further. That point of coming together would mark the beginning of the expansion of the universe and arguably the beginning of the universe itself. Subsequent to that, there were other discoveries in observational astronomy, something called the cosmic background radiation that was discovered in 1965 that provided additional support for this idea. And especially important were developments in theoretical physics based on Einstein's new theory of gravity known as general relativity. His theory implied that matter actually curves the fabric of what he called space-time, that space is curved by a dense concentration of matter. In the 1960s, Stephen Hawking was thinking about this, studying black holes, and realized that if the universe was expanding in the forward direction of time, whereby matter would be getting more and more diffuse, if you back the time sequence up in your mind's eye, the matter again would get more and more densely concentrated, but that would mean that the space of the universe would be getting more and more tightly curved until finally you would reach a limiting point going back in time where the density of matter would go to an infinite and the curvature of space would go to an infinite, at which point you could again go no further back. But that implied a universe that was literally coming out of what they call a spatial-temporal singularity. An infinite curvature corresponds to zero spatial volume. And so you get a picture of everything coming out of nothing in a infinitesimal flash of light and taking no time. It was, in fact, evidence of a creation event. So this is an absolutely fascinating story in astrophysics, astronomy, and cosmology. I should mention that there have been attempts to circumvent the conclusion of an absolute beginning, and they fall under the heading of something called quantum cosmology. And in the debate that I had with Krauss, he's a proponent of that idea. He wrote a book called Universe from Nothing. And I made an unexpected discovery as I was reading the technical papers upon which Krauss's popular book are based, and that is that these theories in quantum cosmology actually have their own theistic implications. As much as the whole enterprise was designed to try to circumvent the theistic implications of standard Big Bang cosmology, quantum cosmology, if true, has its own theistic implications. And we could discuss more about that, but this has been a long answer, so I'll stop.
I do want to press that for just a moment, because when Krauss says nothing, does he really mean nothing, or is he importing something else into that word?
Well, he absolutely is importing something else into that word. his hypothesis is developed in two phases. And one phase involves getting matter out of pre-existing space and energy. And clearly, pre-existing space and energy are not nothing. But then prior to that, the space and the energy are thought to arise in quantum cosmology from a purely mathematical construct, from the laws of physics, the laws of quantum gravity, that are thought to pre-exist the origin of the physical universe of matter, space, time, and energy. And Krauss is, in his book, Universe from Nothing, popularizing the work of the great Russian physicist Alexander Vilenkin at Tufts University. And Vilenkin is a much more sensitive soul philosophically. And at the very end of his book, Many Worlds in One, he asks a very deep question, which is, prior to the existence of matter, space, time, and energy, what tablet could these laws of physics have been written on? After all, the laws of physics as we know them describe the action of matter and energy within space and time. If there's no matter and energy, space, or time, what are these physical laws? Well, he says they're purely mathematical. But pure math is conceptual, and concepts, mathematical or otherwise, exist in minds. And so he asks this very provocative rhetorical question at the end of the book. If prior to the universe, all that exists is mathematics, and therefore an idea, are we therefore saying that a mind predates the universe? After all, ideas, mathematical or otherwise, in our experience, only exist in minds. They don't exist floating around disembodied, if you will, or apart from minds to think them. And so one of the hidden theistic implications of quantum cosmology is that to explain the origin of the universe, the material universe, from math is to imply that a mind predates the matter of the universe. In addition, the math that's used to explain the origin of the universe is something, this gets a little bit technical, but it's something called a universal wave function. And this is a mathematical entity that has an analogous form in ordinary quantum mechanics. And the idea here is the universal wave function is describing not all the different places a particle could be in a quantum mechanical system, but rather all the different gravitational fields associated with all the different universes that might emerge out of this mathematical description of possibilities. But to get that universal wave function, a big hairy equation has to be solved first, and that's something called the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, which is the analog of the famous Schrödinger equation in quantum mechanics. But to solve that equation, which has an infinite number of solutions, the physicists have to impose what are called boundary constraints on it. You can't get a definite solution without choosing constraints that limit degrees of mathematical freedom. And those constraints are chosen with a teleological end in mind. They want to solve the equation in such a way to get a universal wave function that includes our universe as one of the possibilities. If they do that, they think they will have explained the origin of the universe. But to fix those boundary constraints and thus solve the equation, the physicists have to arbitrarily make choices as to how they're going to constrain the degrees of mathematical freedom. When you use those type of equations in other branches of physics, usually there's a physical system that's being described that will allow you to establish what the boundary constraints are. There's no universe yet, so you have to choose those constraints, and those are chosen by the physicists themselves in a way that limits degrees of mathematical freedom. And that's another way of talking about the input of information. Whenever I say zero, not one, or one, not zero, this bit, not that, I'm imparting information. And if you have to fix these boundary constraints to limit an infinite number of solutions to get a specific solution out the other end, you're imparting a huge amount of information in order to get a specific and desired outcome. That's a way of modeling intelligent design. That's not the universe coming from nothing. In fact, I argue in the book, even if Krauss could explain the origin of matter and energy from pure mathematics, which is quite a trick, math doesn't have that power on its own apart from minds, he and other quantum cosmologists cannot explain the origin of the information necessary to get the math that does that explaining in the first place. So that information in their modeling is coming from a mind, that of a theoretical physicist. So I think the whole enterprise of quantum cosmology is presupposing a pre-existing mind, and indeed a mind that must impart information to give a universe with a finely tuned structure that makes life possible.
Yes, across is equivocating on the word nothing. Nothing doesn't really
mean nothing. It's definitely equivocating. But what's presupposed is not matter and energy, ultimately, but rather math and mind.
Yeah, yeah. So, again, the subtitle, Three Scientific Discoveries That Reveal the Mind Behind the Universe, and you've camped on that first one, evidence from cosmology that suggests that the material universe had a beginning. What about physics? The evidence from physics that shows that from the beginning of the universe, there has been the fine-tuning of the universe, which allows for the possibility of life.
Absolutely. This is one of the key evidences that has given defenders of scientific atheism heartburn. I have two colleagues that have debated the late Christopher Hitchens, David Berlinski and Jay Richards. And Hitchens said that the fine-tuning problem was the one that really made him uneasy. And he thought there was a lot there to worry about from an atheistic point of view. Here's the basic discovery. There are multiple parameters, physical parameters, that make it possible for life. And the strength of gravitational attraction, the strength of the other three main fundamental forces of physics, electromagnetism, the strong and weak nuclear forces. The ratios between some of those forces have to be precisely finely tuned to account, for example, the abundance of carbon in the universe. The masses of the elementary particles, the quarks, the electrons, have to fall within very narrow tolerances to make life possible. And the expansion rate of the universe, which is governed in part by an underlying force called the cosmological constant, this was something that Einstein realized must be in play, that if gravity were the only force in the universe, everything would collapse on itself into a great black hole. So there must be an outward pushing force that counteracts the force of gravity that accounts for why we have empty space between material bodies in the universe. And that this force known as the cosmological constant is exquisitely finely tuned. An accepted value, a commonly accepted value, is about 1 × 10⁻⁹ power. To put that in perspective, there are only 10⁻⁸ elementary particles in the entire universe. So getting that one parameter correct by chance would be roughly the same odds as putting a blindfolded person out into space looking for one elementary particle, but not just in our universe, but in 10 billion universes our size. It would be the search space that would have to be traversed, and you'd have to find the particle by chance. And that would give you something of a sense of the odds of getting the fine-tuning of that one parameter, the cosmological constant, right. So there are all these different parameters. Fred Hoyle, the great astrophysicist who was initially an ardent scientific atheist and who dubbed the Big Bang theory the Big Bang as a pejorative to make fun of the idea of the universe having a beginning, was deeply shaken in his atheism by some of the fine-tuning parameters that he himself discovered. And later adopted a kind of proto-theistic position. I had a chance to talk with him when I was a PhD student in Cambridge. He came to give a lecture. And by that time, he was very intrigued with the evidence of design and the fine-tuning and had been quoted as saying that a common sense interpretation of the data we have suggests that a super intellect has monkeyed with physics in order to make life possible. And this has been a common sense interpretation, indeed, of the fine-tuning. The alternate view of that, the go-to atheistic explanation for that now, is something called the multiverse. And that's the idea that, yes, all these different parameters are exquisitely and extremely improbably finely tuned, but if we can posit the existence of enough other universes out there, I like to say a gabillion, not a technical term, but a whole bunch, then we can think of our universe as the lucky winner in a great cosmic lottery, where some universe with the right set of parameters would inevitably arise because of the great number of universes, and we just happen to be in the lucky one. But there are two problems with that. The first is that if all these other universes are causally disconnected from our own, then their mere existence does nothing to affect the probabilities of anything that occurs in our universe, including whatever processes work that set the fine-tuning parameters. So in virtue of that, multiverse proponents have proposed universe-generating mechanisms so that they can portray our universe as the lucky winner of a great lottery, where the generating mechanism is spitting out a whole bunch of different universes at periodic intervals. And that's where the ultimate rub comes in for the multiverse, because even in theory, those universe-generating mechanisms, some based on string theory, others based on something called inflationary cosmology, Even in theory, those universe-generating mechanisms must themselves be exquisitely finely tuned in order to produce new universes. And so even if you accept the multiverse hypothesis, the problem of fine-tuning is just pushed back one generation. You still have prior unexplained fine-tuning in the universe-generating mechanisms, and so you're right back where you started with an evidence that we know from experience, namely fine-tuning, is indicative of prior design, prior intelligent design.
So we're talking about the three key scientific discoveries that reveal the mind behind the universe. We talked about cosmology. We talked about evidence from physics. The third is evidence from biology, which seems to establish that since the beginning, large amounts of new functional genetic information have arisen in our biosphere, and that makes new forms of life possible, and vicariously, it implies the activity of a designing intelligence.
Yes, and an activity well after the beginning of the universe. Our best estimates are that life arose on the planet about 3.85 billion years ago, and then we've had episodes of bursts of biological innovation at different points along the timeline from there forward in events like the Cambrian explosion or the mammalian radiation or the angiosperm big bloom or the origin of human beings. One of the great discoveries of modern biology is that if the evolutionary process is to build new forms of life, it must generate vast amounts of new information. Just as in our computer world, if you want to give your computer a new function, you've got to provide new code. In the biological realm, the building of new biological form and structure, novelty, requires new information. And this insight is a consequence of the great discoveries that occurred in the 1950s and 60s in a period of time that was now historians of science called the molecular biological revolution. Watson Crick elucidated the structure of the DNA molecule in 1953. In 1957, Crick formulates something he calls the sequence hypothesis, the idea that along the interior of the twisting double helix that we know of from high school biology, the DNA molecule, along the interior of that molecule, there are chemical subunits called bases that are functioning like alphabetic characters in a written text or like the zeros and ones in a section of software, the digital characters in this section of software, which is to say it is not the physical properties of those chemical subunits that give DNA its function, but rather their arrangement in accord with an independent symbol convention now known as the genetic code that enables the DNA to store instructions for producing the proteins and protein machines that keep cells alive. And so this discovery of the information-bearing properties of DNA and the whole information storage, transmission, and processing system at work within the cell has created a profound impasse in both chemical evolutionary theory, but also, I would say, in biological evolutionary theory as well, because undirected evolutionary mechanisms have proven incapable of explaining the origin of this informational system in the first place, and even the origin of the amount of new information necessary to build, for example, a novel protein fold, which is the fundamental unit of innovation in biological evolution. And yet, on the other hand, we do know of a cause that produces functional digital information. In our uniform and repeated experience, in fact, there's only one known cause capable of producing that kind of information, and that is a mind. Our local hero out here in the Seattle area, Bill Gates, has said that DNA is like a software program, but much more complex than any we've ever devised. Richard Dawkins himself has acknowledged that the machine code of the genes, as he puts it, is uncannily computer-like. Leroy Hood, a famous biotechnologist, has simply described DNA as containing, quote, digital code. We know from experience that it takes a programmer to make a software program. We know more generally that whenever we find information, especially in a digital or an alphabetic form, and we trace it back to its source, whether we're talking about a hieroglyphic inscription or a paragraph in a book or a computer program or the information that we're transmitting over the radio signal right now, that information always first originated in a mind. And therefore, the discovery of functional digital information at the foundation of life and even the simplest living cells points, I argue, to the activity of a designing mind in the origin and the history of life.
I want to focus just for a moment on the title of your book and think about just about every word of that title. It's not titled The God Hypothesis. It's titled Return of the God Hypothesis. And that seems to imply that there once was a viable scientific option. That viable scientific option, the option of the God Hypothesis, was popular, then lost its popularity, and now is making a breakthrough once again.
Exactly, or at least should be, based on the evidence that we have in front of us, should be making a comeback. And I think it is. But let's start with the beginning of the story that's implied by the title. There is a period in the history of science that historians of science call the scientific revolution. That is a period of time in which scientists began to investigate nature in a very systematic way. And as a result of that, made many important breakthroughs in our understanding of biology, chemistry, astronomy, and physics. That period of time is typically dated as between 1500 and 1750, but now many historians say the roots of the scientific revolution go back even further into the late Catholic medieval period, into the 1300s. And if you look at that period of time, you find that the innovators, both from the standpoint of methodology and from the standpoint of the application of new scientific methods, were devoutly religious people who held a Judeo-Christian or biblical worldview. And when you look at that worldview, it turns out that there are many things in a biblical or theistic worldview that are crucial to developing the kind of science that was developed. I already mentioned the presupposition of intelligibility, the idea that nature could be understood because it was made by a rational mind, namely God, who had made us in his image and granted us the same kind of rationality that he himself had, and which was reflected in the order and design of the universe. Other theological propositions were equally important. The idea that God is a God of order and that there is an impressed order on the universe, so that the concept of natural law became a very natural way of thinking about nature. One historian of science says the idea of the laws of nature was a juridical metaphor of theological origin, but also the idea that the laws of nature were the result of divine choice, and therefore that God made the universe in an orderly way, but he could have imposed a different kind of order on nature than he did. And so we couldn't deduce what the order of nature would be. We rather have to go out and look at nature, observe it. Robert Boyle said, it is not the job of the natural philosopher to discern what God must have done, but rather to go out and look and see what he actually did do. Now, this approach was in decided contrast to the Greek approach to the natural sciences, where the Greeks thought there was an inherent order in nature, but it was an order that was logically necessary and self-evident to anyone who reflected on it. And so this approach to science impeded the impulse to observe. And so there are many contributions from a Judeo-Christian worldview, from a biblical worldview, that made what we call modern science possible. And I describe these in the first couple chapters of the book. But in addition to that, the early scientists who started to use these methods, Kepler, Boyle, Newton, also believed that they were seeing in nature evidence of design. In the general scholium to the Principia, the theological epilogue that Newton wrote to his great masterpiece about wherein he explicated the new universal law of gravity, he made an exquisite initial condition fine-tuning argument about the origin of the solar system. And he argued that this most beautiful system of sun, planets, and comets could only proceed from the counsel and dominion of an intelligent and powerful being, which he capitalized with a capital B. So right in the structure of his scientific work, he was making design arguments. He did the same in the optics, where he argued that the exquisite and intricate design of the eye not only by itself bespoke a prior designing intelligence, but it seemed to anticipate the properties of light in an uncanny way that provided further support for that inference. So the God hypothesis was part of the inspiration for science. It was a presupposition that gave rise to science, but it was also an active explanatory hypothesis that helped to explain some of the things the scientists were discovering. That began to change in the 19th century, as I mentioned already, with the rise of these different theories of origins that excluded God as an explanatory concept. But I think the argument of this book is that the big discoveries that have been made over the last 100 years certainly justify returning the God hypothesis to a place of primacy as an explanatory hypothesis, as well as a source of presuppositions that make science possible.
You mentioned Isaac Newton, and you know, he was a prodigious intellect by any standard. He discovered the laws of motion. He invented calculus. He constructed the first reflecting telescope. Many other laudits that you could attribute to him. And his God hypothesis actually functioned as a hugely productive science starter. So I kind of get the idea reading Return of the God Hypothesis that you are fascinated by Isaac Newton. You mention him a lot in your talks and in your writings.
Well, I do. And my first year in grad school in Cambridge, I did several papers on the debate over universal gravitation, which was fascinating because there I learned that Newton not only made arguments that could be categorized as natural theology. He not only argued from nature to the existence of God, he also had a profoundly biblical theology of nature. For him, the laws of nature were a mode of divine action. This was just a metaphor that we used to describe how God maintained the constancy of nature, the orderly concourse of nature. And he had a fascinating debate through an intermediary with the German philosopher and mathematician Gottfried Leibniz. Leibniz didn't like Newton's new theory of gravity because he thought that Newton had failed to provide a materialistic or mechanistic causal explanation for gravitational attraction. The previous view of gravity was that there was an invisible but material substance called ether that swirled around the sun and the planets, and it pushed the planets around the sun, sort of like dropping sticks in a vortex. Newton got rid of the ether and instead simply described the force of gravitational attraction, and his equations implied that there was something at work called action at a distance. The moon is affecting the tides on planet Earth, we think, but the moon is not touching planet Earth. It doesn't move the water. It doesn't push the water. So what causes the pushing and the pulling? All explanations at this time were thought to require such pushing and pulling. So said what were called the mechanical philosophers, of which Leibniz was one. Newton said, "I don't feign to know the cause." Hypothesis non fingo in the Latin, he said. "I don't know the cause, but I can describe what happens mathematically." And Leibniz thought that since Newton was not positing a material cause for the origin of the universe, he must privately think that the actual cause of gravitational attraction was, as one of my Cambridge supervisors put it, constant spirit action. The orderly concourse of nature that we describe with our laws of nature is a consequence of God sustaining the universe by the word of his power, as it says in the book of Hebrews. And in fact, this is exactly what Newton thought. And he revealed this in a private letter that he wrote to a bishop named Bishop Bentley, who was preparing lectures on natural theology in 1691. And so Newton thought he saw evidence of God in nature. And he also had a kind of profound theology of nature where he understood that what we as scientists are doing in describing these regularities is nothing more than describing the constant spirit action of God in holding the universe together. In fact, in the General Scholium to the Principia, his theological epilogue to the great work, he has a passage that sounds almost like a direct paraphrase of Colossians 1. In him, all things are held together.
One of the great contributions of your book is that you debunk the myth that science and religion are, in fact, at war. You have people like Neil deGrasse Tyson who bloviate that if you want to do good science, you have to throw off the shackles of religion. So again, he highlights this mythological tug of war between science and religion. And you're saying, in essence, that this is mythology, this is made up, that the two are not in conflict one with another.
Well, this has certainly been not the dominant state of affairs in the relationship between science and religious belief, belief in God, theology, since the founding of modern science. There are, of course, tensions between certain scientific theories and theological propositions. I would say that Darwinian evolution, with its denial of actual design and instead its affirmation only of the appearance or illusion of design, does place itself in direct opposition to clear theological teaching or theological propositions. Most Orthodox Jews and Christians believe that God acted in a specific and even discernible way to design the universe and to design life. So it's not the case that there are never contradictions between specific scientific theories and theological ideas or theological beliefs, but rather that if you look at the whole sweep of the history of science, first of all, Judeo-Christian ideas played a crucial role in the foundation and formation of the modern scientific enterprise. And then secondly, I would argue that our best current understanding of the evidence we have about, for example, biological and cosmological origins, among other subjects, does now perfectly harmonize with theological beliefs and provides support for those beliefs. There have been episodes in the history of science where there has been conflict or tension, but that, I would argue, has occurred when the scientific theories in question are actually questionable, like Darwinian evolution. So I think both in its initial formation and now at the present, I think there's a deep harmony between science and religious belief. And in fact, I think scientific discoveries support belief in the existence of God, thus my title, Return of the God Hypothesis.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking when I ask you this question about people like Andrew Dixon White. He was the founder of Cornell University, and he would come up with these pseudoscientific statements that really had no basis in fact, reality, or history. So, for example, he, in one of his books, decries the regrettable reality that the 200 years after Magellan had empirically proven that the Earth was round, that Christian fundamentalists persisted in perpetuating flat Earth mythology. But that in itself is mythology. It's propaganda.
It's a huge myth, Hank. And there's a terrific book that's been written about the myth of the flat Earth. I think the author's name was Jeffrey Russell. It's been a while. I met him once. I may be getting the name wrong, but it's now well established. The spherical nature of the Earth was well known in the Middle Ages and even before. And these revisionist works of history of science in the late 19th century, the warfare between science and Christianity and by Draper and White, these were appallingly bad pieces of historiography, even at the time. Yes, there was some tension at the time between the Darwinians and Orthodox Jews and Christians about the creation of life. But that was by no means the dominant feature of the interaction between people of faith and scientists. In fact, many scientists, as I pointed out, were profoundly religious people who were doing science for profoundly religious reasons. There's a great book by the historian of science, Rodney Stark, who was here at the University of Washington for many years, where I am in Seattle, and then now at Baylor University, called For the Glory of God. And it's a history of the scientific revolution published by Princeton University Press. This is well known now to historians of science. The religious contribution to the origins of modern science is well known and documented by leading historians of science. So these late 19th century revisionist works, as well as these popularizations that we get in things like the reboot of the Cosmos series or the original Cosmos series, by Neil deGrasse Tyson, or before him, Carl Sagan. This is a really appallingly bad history of science when we tell the public that science and religion are at war, or that religious ideas are science stoppers and the like.
In your book, you highlight three metaphors that are used to describe nature during the scientific revolution. And I want to go through each one of those, starting with the book of nature. One of the things I've pointed out in my own writings is something that Albert Einstein said with respect to the book of nature. He said he saw himself as a little child entering a huge library filled with books in many different languages. The child knows someone must have written those books. It does not know how. It does not understand the languages in which those books were written. The child dimly suspects a mysterious order in the arrangement of the books, but doesn't know what it is. That said, Albert Einstein, that, it seems to me, is the attitude of even the most intelligent human being toward God. And of course, as I've pointed out, Einstein rejected the personal God of the Bible, but he did revere the God who gives glimpses of himself in the library of nature. That by way of prologue to your discussion of the Book of Nature.
Hey, I absolutely love that quotation. I wanted to use it, but the publishers thought I was encumbering my second chapter with too much stuff, so we cut that. But it's a lovely quote. And it shows that Einstein believed in a God with a mind. It wasn't a completely impersonal God, but it was a God with a mind of some kind, and there was a mind behind the universe. But that metaphor of the Book of Nature goes back to the period of the Scientific Revolution and before into late medieval theology. You find that metaphor being used by St. Thomas Aquinas. And the idea there is simple, that just as God reveals himself through the Book of Scripture, he also reveals himself through the Book of Nature. Nature is revelatory of the reality and the mind of God. And that metaphor also underscored this notion of intelligibility, that just as we can read the Book of Scripture and understand it, we can read the Book of Nature and understand it. And therefore, this gives impetus to the empirical investigation of the natural world. A second metaphor was in common currency. And here, the use of these metaphors actually seals the case for the theological inspiration of modern science. The other big one was the idea of the laws of nature. There are laws of nature. There are orderly patterns that we can describe in a law-like way because there is a lawgiver and a sustainer of the orderly concourse of the universe, namely God. And the third metaphor that was commonly used was the idea of a clock. And this was not used as a deistic idea that God set things up in motion and let them run. It was later perhaps co-opted by deists, but it was used to convey the idea of design, that just as a clock has many different parts that function in a coordinated fashion to achieve an overall end, nature and specific natural systems, like clocks, have many integrated parts that allow them to function in a way that performs an overall function or achieves an end. And the different parts of nature function together in much the way different parts of a clock do. So you had the universe as a clock, the universe as a book, and the universe as a lawful realm, all of which conveyed this deep theological inspiration for doing science in the first place.
How did we get from someone like Newton to someone like Dawkins, from the idea that intelligent design is self-evident to the notion that intelligent design is absurd, so absurd that it is in fact rendered delusion? In other words, what I'd like you to do is expand on the enormous intellectual shift that has taken place in Western civilization from the founding of modern science to where we are today.
Right. Well, there's two main phases of that, and it's a huge story, of course, but I try to distill it as best I can in the third chapter of my book. The first phase of the shift occurs in philosophy before we really get to science. In the Enlightenment, the idea is that whereas previously Christian thinkers believed that reason was a gift of God and it was best used in dependence on revelation and a dependence on assumptions that made sense in light of a Judeo-Christian worldview, the Enlightenment philosophers thought that reason could be used autonomously from God. And they also, many of them, Hume in particular, argued that many of the classical proofs for the existence of God were invalid. They didn't work. And this shift in philosophy is taking place in the 18th century. In the 19th century, we begin to see the impact of that way of thinking on the practice of science itself, as scientific theories are proposed to explain the origin of different features of life in the physical universe apart from any God hypothesis. So there's a famous, probably apocryphal tale that is told of an encounter between Napoleon and the French physicist Pierre Laplace. Napoleon did summon Laplace to his palace in 1802 to commend him for a work on the origin of the solar system called the celestial mechanics. And he did apparently ask Laplace about why he didn't mention God in his scientific work in the way that Sir Isaac Newton did. The apocryphal part probably is the off-quoted answer that Laplace is said to have given, where he puffs himself up and says, "Sire, I have no need of that hypothesis." Well, William Herschel, the great English astronomer, was present at the meeting, and his description doesn't include that quote, but it does convey that Laplace had that sort of an attitude, that he was attempting to explain everything without reference to God. And he was attempting to do the very thing that Newton said could not be done in the General Scholium to the Principia. Newton said that you could explain the ongoing movement of the planets by reference to the law of gravity, but you couldn't explain the original position of the planets, the sun, the comets, the fine-tuning of that system by the mere law of gravity alone. Laplace attempted to do that. Then in geology, you had figures like Lyell and others who were attempting to explain the origin of the great mountains and canyons and river deltas by reference to slow, gradual, undirected processes. Many of those explanations were perfectly sufficient, but they also captured the same spirit of the age of sort of godless explanations for the origin of things. And then Darwin came along and attempted to explain the origin of new forms of life by natural selection rather than by an act of divine creation. And so by the end of the 19th century, you have this quite seamless account of natural history, going back to the origin of the solar system, to planet Earth, to the origin of new forms of life, eventually even human life, and even the origin of the first life itself out of the primordial prebiotic soup. And so there's a kind of seamless narrative that accounts for everything with no need of the God hypothesis. And that, plus shifts in philosophy, convince most intellectuals, as Richard Dawkins has said, that, well, God might exist, but his existence is rendered extremely improbable by all these otherwise materialistic explanations.
Something else you do in your book that I think is instructive is you talk about the lack of Christian unity and how this lack of unity, this religious conflict that was pitting Catholics against Protestants and so forth, actually was a negative influence in the shift towards scientific materialism.
Well, right. In the wake of the religious wars of the 16th, 17th, and even 18th century, there was a shift away from specific doctrinal affirmations towards a more generic kind of deism that eventually evolved, if you will, into a more completely naturalistic worldview. So you went from a theistic worldview where God was viewed as the creator and a God who was both transcendent and active in the creation, to a deistic worldview where God might have set things in motion but had nothing to do with the universe and human affairs after the beginning of the universe, to a view where God likely did not exist at all. And some of this was simply an emotional or reflexive, aversive response to the distasteful and troubling wars that took place between Christians of different doctrinal affiliations. If doctrine is causing wars, let's get rid of doctrine, I think was the kind of the spirit. So yeah, I think that's part of the story for sure.
Well, one of the things that I will criticize your book for, in fact, I'll even call it criminal, is that you take the best, the most concise refutation of David Hume, the refutation of his famed argument against miracles, and you relegate that to a footnote.
Well, I'm a huge critic of Hume, so I could obviously have said a lot more, but to me, his argument against miracles is itself criminal. It's so bad because he, on the one hand, claims that the laws of nature are nothing more than habits of the mind. They don't reflect anything real about the natural world. And then he turns around and says that these laws of nature, which he has already relegated to a status in philosophy is called ontological. The laws of nature have no ontological status. Then he turns around and says, but they can stop miracles from happening. If laws of nature are only ideas in our own minds, then they can't stop anything from happening in nature, whether miraculous or otherwise. So I accept your point, Hank. I could have said a lot more about that.
But, no, it was tongue-in-cheek, obviously. But I mean,
well,
this
probably guarding against a rant, because I used to, when I was a philosophy professor, there's one guy that would get me going for his simplistic thinking. on miracles, at least, it was Hume. He's quite persuasive about the problem of induction. But if you accept his account of the problem of induction, then you have no grounds for disregarding the possibility of miracles a priori, as he does.
Yeah, what I was trying to say with my tongue-in-cheek attempt at humor here was that getting your book is worthwhile not only for reading its content, but also for reading every one of the footnotes, because here you have this incredible refutation of David Hume, and it's relegated to a footnote.
Well, there was a sweet lady who came up to me at a conference, and it might have been the conference that I sometimes attend in Charlotte, and she said, well, my husband loves your books, and he's even read all of the footnotes. And I said, well, I really apologize. I'm very sorry. You've been made an intelligent design widow, you know.
I do want to mention for everybody listening in that your book, an incredible resource, Return of the God Hypothesis, Three Scientific Discoveries That Reveal the Mind Behind the Universe, is available for anyone who stands shoulder to shoulder with us in the battle for life and truth. You can get your copy on the web. For your support, simply go to the web at equip.org. You can also write me at Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. So you can go to the web, equip.org. You can write me, or you can talk to our resource consultants, 888-7000, and the letters CRI. There's so much in this book that's important for us to absorb. Because this is, and again, I want to go back before we continue the discussion somewhat, go back to the significance of this subject. This is not just a subject. I used to say it's not just an apologetic argument. This is the apologetic argument. How one views their origins ultimately will determine how they live their life. Expand on that.
Well, the origins theories function as surrogates for larger worldviews. They don't exactly prove, say, theism versus materialism. But if you accept, for example, Darwinian evolution plus chemical evolution plus the multiverse, you're pretty much on your way to adopting a wholesale materialistic worldview, because you've attempted to give an account of how everything arose by purely undirected material processes. And given the application of Occam's razor, you really needn't posit anything else to explain things. And so the simplest explanation, if you accept the adequacy of those explanations in combination, is really a universe in which there is no God. And that's exactly the kind of argument that Richard Dawkins, Stephen Hawking, and others have made, that the simplest explanation in light of those, the presumption of the adequacy of those theories is that there is no God. On the other hand, if you see that there's evidence of actual design in life or the universe, evidence of design that arises long after the universe in life, evidence of design from the very beginning of the universe in the, say, fine-tuning of the laws of physics and chemistry, in other words, if you accept the kind of argument that I make in the book, that perspective on origins has implications that are affirmative of theism. Then all kinds of things flow from those two competing worldview perspectives. If you're a materialist, as Alex Rosenberg stated in the quote you gave earlier in the interview, you can't really affirm an objective distinction between right and wrong. What we mean by moral propositions are just instincts that were programmed into us by the evolutionary process. Morality is not a matter of an objective standard above us all to which we can appeal. Rather, it's just my preference or your preference about how we think things ought to be. We end up with a relativistic system of ethics most commonly. We also have a very hard time affirming any ultimate meaning to human existence, because there's no personal source or purpose behind the universe. We are the product of a cosmic accident or two along the way. And when we die, we rot. And there's nothing about our personhood that will persist beyond our physical death. And so it's hard to imagine that anything we achieve will have any lasting value or meaning beyond the few people who might remember our achievements for a short period of time after we die. On the other hand, theism does provide a basis for understanding an objective difference between right and wrong. It provides an objective basis for morality. It affirms the ultimate meaning of a human person, because each person is made in the image of God. And that God is personal. And if that God also has the potential to confer life everlasting, then there is a possibility of eternal life in a meaningful relationship between persons. Again, meaning is something conferred by persons, and I would say is best found in relationship between persons. So a personal, purposive source for the universe gives rise to a very different view of the ultimate significance of human life and existence. And you can follow that chain of logic right down the line. Very hard to account for the reliability of the human mind on what's called naturalistic epistemology. If we're the product of undirected, unguided material processes that only maximize survival rather than truth, then the minds we have may be no better than those of the lower animals or even the insects who are surviving quite fine, thank you very much. Whereas if you accept theism, you have good reason to believe that the rational God who made our minds and who also made the world intended our minds as reliable instruments to know his creation. And therefore, there's a basis for epistemological realism, for believing in the reliability of the mind and our ability to know the world. So I think there are huge philosophical consequences and practical consequences in life as to whether one adopts a materialistic or a theistic worldview. And I think the great news is that the evidence actually supports a theistic worldview, and a theistic worldview, I think, confers a much greater sense of meaning and purpose on human existence. Or if a theistic worldview is true, there is a possibility of finding genuine meaning and purpose in relation to other persons and in relation to the personal God who made us.
You've mentioned the phrase fine-tuning a number of times in this discussion, and I want you to expand on how scientific materialists explain this fine-tuning, particularly when they use the idea of a multiverse. Assess that idea, that hypothesis.
Well, right. The multiverse, again, is the idea that there are many, many, many other universes out there. In fact, so many that in one of them, the combination of physical parameters would have to be set just right somewhere to allow for the possibility of life, and we just happen to be in the lucky universe. Remember, the ultimate fact that needs to be explained is the immense improbability associated with getting these many separate and independent fine-tuning parameters set just right to allow for a life-conducive universe. You fiddle with a cosmological constant by a tiny smidge one way or another, and you either get a heat death of the universe where all the matter and energy of the universe becomes too diffuse to allow for even stable galaxies and rocky planets, or if you fiddle with it in the other direction, you get a giant collapse and a black hole universe. And it doesn't take much of a fiddling of the dial to produce either of these adverse effects, and that applies not only to the cosmological constant, but to many, many other fine-tuning parameters. And so the multiverse is an attempt to explain the improbability associated with getting all the dials set to the right settings, if you will, by positing the existence of many, many other universes. But the problem with the multiverse hypothesis is, well, twofold. In the book, I explain that to explain the two different types of fine-tuning that we find in the universe, the fine-tuning of the initial arrangement of matter and energy and the fine-tuning of the fundamental parameters of physics, the strength of the basic forces and the masses of elementary particles and the like, there are actually two different types of universe-generating mechanisms required. You have to have inflationary cosmology to explain the fine-tuning of the initial conditions of the universe, and you need a universe-generating mechanism based on string theory to explain the different combinations of laws and constants of physics. But when you look at those two different universe-generating mechanism ideas, they require multiple what are called pure theoretical postulates or entities, things that we can't possibly verify. We simply posit them because of their ability to explain. Nothing wrong with that, but what occurs in the multiverse hypothesis is the proliferation of such theoretical entities. In string theory, you have to believe that strings are the fundamental units of reality. You have to believe that there are little bits of energy that wrap around the strings to constrain them in just the right way. In inflationary cosmology, you have to believe in something called an inflaton field. You have to believe that there are finely tuned inflaton shutoff energies. In my book, I list 10 separate pure theoretical postulates that are held by these two different theories that give rise to universe-generating mechanisms, 10 abstract theoretical postulates that you have to affirm, as opposed to the one single postulate of a transcendent intelligence. And so by Occam's razor, the theistic design hypothesis is much simpler and much more parsimonious than the multiverse hypothesis, where you have to, in addition to all the theoretical postulates associated with the universe generating mechanisms, you also have to believe in all those billions and billions of other universes. Then secondly, the second big problem is that even in the multiverse hypothesis, you still have prior unexplained fine-tuning, because it turns out that in theory, those universe generating mechanisms that are necessary for the multiverse proponent to portray our universe as something like the lucky winner of a great cosmic lottery, those underlying universe generating mechanisms, even in theory, must be exquisitely finely tuned to allow them to produce new universes. And so the multiverse hypothesis presupposes prior unexplained fine-tuning, the very thing it was designed to explain in the first place. So we're right back to where we started. And yet, in our experience, what we mean by fine-tuning is an ensemble of improbable parameters that work jointly to accomplish some discernible end or exemplify some set of functional requirements. So finely tuned systems in our experience would include things like finely tuned French recipes, finely tuned internal combustion engines, finely tuned combinations of electrical parts to create a radio receiver, for example. In our experience, fine tuning is always the product of intelligent design. And if it is the case, and it is the case that the multiverse hypothesis does not ultimately explain the origin of fine tuning, but merely pushes the question back one generation, then the best explanation, and in fact, the only known cause of fine-tuning, remains intelligent design. And therefore, even if the multiverse hypothesis is true, it doesn't circumvent the implication of fine-tuning, namely that there must have been a prior designing agent responsible for it.
I find it really interesting that someone of the intellectual capacity of a Stephen Hawking, someone who you seem to have a soft spot in your heart for, at least that's what I perceive when I hear you speak of him, and in your books you mention him, but he held to this multiverse hypothesis. And yet a colleague, Roger Penrose, pointed out that this hypothesis, just as you said, is impotent and misconceived.
Well, one of the things you find with the great scientists is that, and associated with all these discoveries, the sympathy for an alternative that is non-design, non-theistic hypothesis is not really driven by the scientific evidence itself. These are questions in the end of science, but also of philosophy. And Hawking was a great scientist, but I think he was a rather weak philosopher. And I do have a tremendous soft spot for him. I think his personal story was tremendously inspiring. I was fortunate to attend a lecture series while I was a PhD student in Cambridge that was the basis of his book, A Brief History of Time. But Hawking was a kind of God-obsessed atheist. He was fascinated with the big questions. I think the most important work he did was in proving the singularity theorems. In fact, he first formulated the idea of the cosmological singularity in his 1966 PhD dissertation. And in his examination, he was encouraged by Roger Penrose, one of the examiners, to develop the mathematical case for the singularity theorem in more detail, which he did collaboratively with Penrose and then with George Ellis. So he made one of the great discoveries, I think, of all time in physics, which is that he used theoretical physics to reinforce the conclusion that the universe must have a beginning. But then he bristled and bridled at that the rest of his scientific career and formulated the first major theory of quantum cosmology. And in the book, of course, as I explained before in the interview, I argue that quantum cosmology, if true, has its own latent or tacit theistic implications. So I don't think Hawking really ever got around it. But he also had a fundamental confusion in his thinking that was philosophical in character. He liked to say that the laws of physics made clear why there was a universe, you know, how the universe came into existence. There is such a thing as the law of gravity, he said, helps to explain how the universe came into existence. And we don't need to invoke God to light the blue touch paper that sparks everything and gets things going. But there's a fundamental confusion. The laws of physics do not explain where things came from. They don't even explain why specific events happen. The laws of physics describe how matter and energy interact with each other in a mathematical way, in a regular way. They describe those interactions once you have matter and energy. They don't tell you where the matter and energy or the space and time came from in the first place. They're not explanations for causal origins. They're descriptions of natural regularities. And Krauss is subject to the same philosophical error. They treat the laws of nature as if they were causes of things rather than descriptions of regularities. And the one thing we know they certainly didn't cause is the origin of the universe itself, because prior to the origin of matter, space, time, and energy, there is nothing for the laws of nature to describe.
Talk about panspermia, directed or undirected. It's become popularized in our culture. I see all these segments, for example, on Tucker Carlson, where he's talking about unidentified aerial phenomena or UFOs. Discuss how this got so popular and possible problems with what has been popularized on television in this regard.
Well, right. I mean, this is going to be very popular, and I'm not sure when you're airing this interview, but on June 25th, there will be a report from the Navy on some of these visual phenomena that have raised suspicions about the possible existence of visitations in our airspace from intelligent aliens. I'm very skeptical about the interpretations of those phenomena that suggest that aliens have visited our planet, but I doubt that the Navy's report is going to settle the question one way or another. There are many alternative interpretations of those phenomena, and so I'm sure that debate will go on. But the reason that scientists have proposed the existence or activity of aliens has nothing to do with these visual phenomena that the pilots have reported, but rather the difficulty associated with the problem of the origin of the first life on Earth. Francis Crick famously was quoted in the book called Life Itself as saying that an honest man armed with all the data that we have could only say that in some sense the origin of life is almost a miracle. So many were the conditions that would have had to have been set to get life going. So pretty close but rough paraphrase there of his quotation. And he posited the idea of intelligent life being seeded here on Earth because he recognized that the conditions on the early Earth were not conducive to a spontaneous chemical origin of life, still less the origin of the information that would be needed to produce life. So he posited that life had first arisen on some other planet and then had evolved into a highly intelligent form of life and some civilization, and that those intelligent aliens seeded life on Earth. He then kind of backed off from that because he got a lot of pushback from his colleagues and said that he would never formulate any ideas about the origin of life ever again. Richard Dawkins, in a 2008 film, Expelled, similarly speculated about life being seeded here on Earth after being asked by Ben Stein in the film about the problem of the origin of life. And Dawkins, interestingly, said, well, there might well be a signature of intelligence inside cells, which got my attention because I was at the time writing a book called Signature in the Cell. But he said it would have had to have arisen by an evolutionary process somewhere else in the cosmos, and then those intelligent agents that evolved from the life that arose somewhere else would have seeded life to our planet. I think that scientists have resorted to such speculative hypotheses tells you something about the difficulty of the problem of the origin of life, but also that they've invoked intelligence of some kind also tells you that what they're seeing inside living cells justifies an inference to intelligent design. Dawkins just recently tweeted that he was knocked sideways by the evidence of the complex and intricate data processing system that is at work inside cells, and he provided a link to an animation of DNA replication that had been produced by an Australian medical group. That didn't lead him to question his atheism, but on other occasions, these signatures of intelligence inside cells have led him to speculate about alien intelligence as being the source of the integrated complexity and design we're seeing in the living cell. I think the panspermia hypothesis has an obvious defect or two. First, it only pushes the question of the ultimate origin of life and the ultimate origin of information off onto some other planet without explaining how information could have arisen from simpler non-living chemicals. And that has been the main source of the impasse that afflicts modern chemical evolutionary theory in the field of origin of life studies among scientists studying the origin of life on Earth. So the main question has just been begged. They've just pushed the problem out into space without solving it. But secondly, no being within the cosmos, intelligent or otherwise, alien or otherwise, could account for the origin of the universe itself or the origin of the fine-tuning of the universe for life that makes the existence of any form of life, terrestrial or otherwise, possible. So positing an extraterrestrial intelligence within the cosmos doesn't tell you where the cosmos came from or how it got finely tuned so that a terrestrial intelligence or extraterrestrial intelligence could have evolved over time. So the panspermia space alien designer hypothesis might explain the origin of life on some other planet. I think if it does so, it does so very weakly, but it certainly doesn't explain the fine tuning of the universe or its ultimate origin. And thus, that's another reason that I favor a theistic design hypothesis as the best explanation for that ensemble of evidence for those big three discoveries that have been made about the origin of the universe, its fine tuning, and the origin of life and the information necessary to produce it.
I want to get to a couple of other subjects quickly, subjects that you talk about in your book. One of them being how critics of intelligent design consistently are misrepresenting intelligent design as a God of the gaps argument, an argument from ignorance.
Yeah, this is consistent and probably one of the most popular objections to the case for intelligent design. An argument from ignorance has the following form. In an argument from ignorance or a gaps argument, you say, well, cause A is not capable of producing effect X. Therefore, cause B must have done it. But in saying that, you offer no evidence that cause B is capable of producing effect X. You're arguing purely on your ignorance about what cause B can or cannot do. That's not the kind of argument we're making in support of intelligent design. We're saying that natural processes, known natural processes of various kinds, those that are based on chance, those are based on natural laws, those are based on the combination of the two, have not demonstrated the capability of producing, for example, functional digital information. Yet we do know of another cause, let's call that cause B, namely intelligent agency, which is known to produce functional digital information. We have independent experience or reason to think that minds can produce the kind of information that we find in living cells and that we find in other systems, such as computer codes. So we're not arguing from our ignorance of what the alternative cause can do, but rather we're arguing based on our knowledge of what the cause can do. And therefore, the argument is not an argument from ignorance, but rather it has a different logical structure, which is known as an inference to the best explanation. Now, I extend that defense of intelligent design to the God hypothesis itself by bringing in other considerations about how you can establish what's known as causal adequacy for a theoretical entity, and showing that what we do in making the case, or what I do in making the case for the God hypothesis as a better explanation than, for example, naturalism, pantheism, deism, or space alien designer hypotheses, is to show that we have good reason to think that the concept of God has associated with it certain attributes that give God what we call the causal power to produce the effects in question, that there are positive reasons to think that if God exists, then God would provide a better explanation of the facts, because associated with the concept of God are certain causal powers, which are precisely the ones you would need to account for the things that we see in the universe around us. It's a little bit of a variation on the Dawkins riff, where he says the properties of the universe are exactly what we would expect if at bottom there was no purpose, no design, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. I argue that the great discoveries that have been made about biological and cosmological origins and about the nature of life itself, the nature of the universe, are precisely what we would expect if God existed and had acted to bring the universe and life into existence. And that argument takes a little bit more space to unpack, but I do that in chapter 20, the penultimate chapter of the book, where I'm responding to some of these philosophical objections to the case, both for intelligent design and for a larger theistic design hypothesis of the kind I defend in the new book.
I wonder if you can weigh in for a moment on the rise in popularity of theistic evolution. Could the information in DNA have been front-loaded into the Big Bang, as so many theistic evolutionists seem to be proposing in the present?
Well, I have a whole chapter on this. I actually think the popularity of theistic evolution is now on the wane. It's mainly been popular among Christian college biology professors. It's not greatly popular in the wider Christian church, among people who sit in the pews, if you will, or even among the clergy. It's mainly an attempt to reconcile the dominant viewpoint about biological origins that is part of the guild, if you will, of professional biologists with the theological teachings or the theological affirmations that professors at Christian colleges are expected to affirm. So I don't think it has a huge following, but it has had a fairly discouraging effect, I think, on the worldview of Christian students who attend colleges like that. And I found this when I was teaching at Whitworth University. Many of my colleagues in the biology department were theistic evolutionists. Students who encountered their perspective on this subject would say, well, if that's true, why are we affirming the theistic part of this? If Darwinian evolution can explain everything, why do we need to bring God into the picture at all? And that's just one of many problems with it. I've helped edit a book called Theistic Evolution, a Scientific, Philosophical, and Theological Critique, which is very comprehensive in exposing the different problems with theistic evolution. One, I think, that's fairly simple to understand, I think, is that the tension between scientific theory that denies any evidence of actual design and the clear theological teaching of both Judeo and Christian theism that says that God actively designed life in the universe. There's an obvious tension there. And theistic evolutionists have been a bit diffident about explaining what exactly they mean by theistic evolution. And one question to put to them, I think, that's a fair one is, when you say you're a theistic evolutionist, are you talking about a guided or an unguided process? And typically, theistic evolutionists will either say an unguided process, or they'll say, I don't know, I'm not sure, we can't tell. But either way, you don't have a clear affirmation of God doing something actively that brings life in the universe into existence. His role as a creator is diminished by this perspective, theologically speaking. Scientifically, I think it's a mess. I've already mentioned that you have leading evolutionary biologists now saying that the mutation selection mechanism lacks the creative power to generate morphological innovation in the history of life. This is a major problem. This was what the mechanism was designed to explain, the origin of major innovation in the history of life, where new forms of life came from. In a 2003 or 4 book with MIT Press, two leading evolutionary biologists, Gerd Müller and Stuart Newman, listed the origin of biological form as an unsolved problem of modern evolutionary theory. And Gerd Müller reaffirmed that in his talk at the Royal Society conference in 2016. So at just the time, oddly, that we have leading evolutionary biologists, secular evolutionary biologists saying, hey, we need a new theory of evolution. The mutation selection mechanism lacks the creative power to account for the origin of a new form and therefore the appearance of design in living organisms. We have biologists in Christian institutions and at think tanks like BioLogos doubling down on the notion of theistic evolution and saying that the Darwinian process was in some way God's way of creating. I think that's just very odd and ironic because, first of all, if it's not a truly creative mechanism, then why would we attribute divine creativity to it? And then finally, to get to your specific question, one form of theistic evolution is, and there are many different versions of the theory, but one idea is that the information needed to build life was front-loaded at the beginning of the universe, and that the design was all put in at the beginning, and then it just unfolded naturally from that point forward. And therefore, there's no need to invoke the activity of God long after the beginning of the universe in such a way as would affirm the activity of the Creator in the created order after the beginning. I show in the book that this is implausible for a number of reasons. Some of it has to do with the specifics of the DNA molecule, but it turns out that the subunits of the DNA molecule do not have inherent in themselves the properties that would ensure that they arrange themselves into information-rich sequences of the bases that carry the information in DNA. you could have all the sugars, the phosphates, and the bases in a prebiotic soup, all primed to form DNA, but there's nothing in the chemical properties or forces of attraction between those subunits that would ensure that they would arrange themselves into information-bearing molecules. And if the chemical subunits of DNA don't have those properties, then certainly the elementary particles or the plasma state that existed in the early universe just after the Big Bang would not have the properties, the self-organizational properties that would produce the information that would ensure that life would arise. If the information isn't in the relevant chemical subunits of DNA, it's not in the elementary particles just after the Big Bang or the plasma just after the Big Bang. And besides that, any information-carrying system that you could imagine would be quickly destroyed by the intense heat that existed in the universe up until at least 380,000 years. We don't even get stable atoms until about 380,000 years after the Big Bang. So there's no conceivable information-carrying vehicle that could survive that and make the front-end loaded design hypothesis credible. A whole bunch of other reasons I offer in opposition to that idea in the book, but that's a part of chapter 15 in the new book, Return of the God Hypothesis.
Perhaps one final question, and I'm not sure exactly how to frame this question, but we hear, in particular during the pandemic, we've heard follow the science or follow the science wherever it leads. And it seems to me that oftentimes the idea of science is confabulated with the idea of pseudoscience. Could you weigh in on that?
Well, pseudoscience is usually a term of abuse that is reserved for scientists who hold a different view than the one that you favor. And there's an awful lot of, in many, many discussions now, appeals to quote-unquote settled science or consensus science. And it's almost a rule with me now that when you hear scientists refer to settled science or to consensus, that they're usually doing so in order to silence scientific dissent, in order to settle a debate that isn't settled. No one invokes settled science or consensus science to justify the claim that the formula for water is H2O, or the formula for salt is NaCl, or that Newton's inverse square law has a particular form. You only invoke settled science when you're trying to shut somebody up who has a different interpretation of the scientific evidence than you do, and to suppress dissenting opinion. And so underlying that common appeal that's being made to settled science in our culture today, whether it's about climate change or Darwinian evolution or any one of the many scientific issues that were in play during the pandemic, the use of settled science as a kind of rhetorical club or cudgel betrays a false understanding of the way science works. Science doesn't work as scientists speak univocally and provide a set of unquestioned deliverances to the rest of us. Rather, science advances as scientists argue about how to interpret the evidence. At some point in most subjects, we get to a point where there's not a lot of debate any longer and there is a consensus. But when that happens, you don't need to appeal to consensus. And if you use an appeal to consensus to subvert the process of theory evaluation, comparative theory evaluation, and argumentation that's necessary to the advance of science, you're actually doing something profoundly unscientific. There's a wonderful Italian philosopher of science, Marcello Pera. Pera says that science advances as scientists argue about how to interpret evidence. There's a rhetorical dimension to science. And if we subvert that, if we suppress that by premature appeals to science or by allowing groupthink to have its head, we will undermine the very scientific enterprise and prevent scientists from getting to the truth, getting to the best explanation or the best interpretation of the evidence, which is what we want. So we have to be very careful about those appeals to consensus. They can be applied in a way that actually undermines the very process of science itself.
Well, this has been just an incredible discussion, Dr. Stephen Meyer. I love the way you communicate both verbally and in writing. And let me simply say this. Those listening in ought to have three books in their library. Amongst the many books, hopefully you are reading the many books you have in your library. One is Darwin's Doubt. This is the explosive origin of animal life and the case for intelligent design. The second book is Signature in the Cell, has to do with DNA and the evidence for intelligent design. And the third, the latest book in the three, and Stephen Meyer loves to do things in threes, is Return of the God Hypothesis, three scientific discoveries that reveal the mind behind the universe. I thoroughly enjoyed reading this book. When I first got it, and I knew I was going to do this podcast with you, I thought, you know, I've only got a short time to read the book, and I don't know if I'm going to get through the whole book. But when I first started reading that book, I was immediately gripped by your storytelling prowess, and it helped me work my way through the book. And this is a subject that I love and a subject that I think that everyone needs to love as well. Return of the God Hypothesis. Nothing more important than being able to demonstrate what David said. The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day, they pour forth speech. Night after night, they proclaim knowledge. There's no speech or language where their voice is not heard. Their words go out to the ends of the earth. Or as St. Paul says, God's eternal power, divine nature, clearly seen through what has been made, so that men are without excuse. Dr. Stephen Meyer, thank you so much for the quality of time you have devoted to the Hank Unplugged podcast.
Oh, thank you for being so well and deeply prepared for this discussion. It's been just really a joy to talk to you, and great to be back in touch as well.
Well, it's been my pleasure, and I hope everyone listening in gets those three books. And do remember, Hank Unplugged is a podcast that is getting its audience, not just in the United States or in Western culture, but now around the world. It is a podcast that is used in various forums, including the Bible Instrument broadcast and a brand new show that I'm doing on WABC in New York, Truth Matters, Life Matters More. So a lot of ways in which you can connect with this material. But please get the book. It is available for anyone who stands shoulder to shoulder with me in the battle for life and truth. My thanks to Dr. Stephen Meyer and for all of you to tuning in to this edition of Hank Unplugged. So long for now.